And you are listening to The Green Majority. I'm your host, Darren Kaster. We are going to be having a bit of a watery theme this week. It is, of course, World Water Day today, which is March 22nd. I'm going to be joined in just a moment. I've got Liz Rice back in the studio as well. She was in a few weeks ago talking about the Citizen Climate Lobby. We're going to have her talk about a few other things today. It was so nice to have her. We decided to have her right back. And then in the second half, we've got this will probably be the most Canadian-esque interview we've ever done. We are actually going to be interviewing Jari Osborne, who's the producer and director of The Beaver Whisperer. That's right, a documentary on the nature of things about beavers. So how more Canadian could that possibly be? It's going to be lots of fun. We've got some clips from the documentary. We'll be talking to her a little bit later. But right, let's get started. Liz, thank you so much for coming back.
Thanks, Darren.
And so one of the main things we're going to talk about, there's a few things today. We're going to kind of discuss a general water theme. I know you've got a couple of announcements. I've got a couple of announcements. We'll kind of sneak them in as we go through here. But right off the bat, the most important thing, the number one topic, was that last time you were on a few weeks ago, you were mentioning as part of the main page and the main one of the main things that you use to sort of say, here's the problem and we're the solution as far as Citizen Climate Lobby itself was, you have it right front and center on your website, which is the preview for the documentary Chasing Ice. So today, because it is World Water Day and because there's some more screenings coming up, and because I have now, since last interview, actually seen the documentary myself and loved it, we're going to be talking a little bit more detail about that as well. So why don't we start there? And just in case anyone was not around for the last time that we talked about this, if you just want to just remind us again exactly what is this documentary Chasing Ice?
Sure, Darren. It's one of the National Geographic photographers. It's a documentary about him. And he goes basically in cold regions all over the world, and he's filming and taking photographs of ice glaciers retreating. So it's a very visually stunning film. It's going to be shown again in Toronto, actually Monday night at the Bloor Hot Docs Theatre, which is going to be at 8:45. And we're going to be using this again. Citizens Climate Lobby is going to be using this as an opportunity to speak to people afterwards. The interesting thing about James Balog's journey in making this film and coming to this career path, where now he's basically completely dedicated to this project, which is called the Extreme Ice Survey, or EIS for short. And it was interesting to hear him say that 20 years ago, he was a climate change skeptic. And he said that he just couldn't believe that humans would be able to impact the chemistry and physics of the planet. And through his photography, he has been completely changed his mind. And this is now his life purpose, is basically to show these images and to go around the world speaking about the retreating glaciers.
I mean, now that I've seen the film myself, it's the sort of thing where you'd use the turn of phrase, you know, the evidence just slaps you across the face. He was almost nearly literally slapped across the face with it in the documentary. There's many, many scenes there of very harrowing feats, dangling over cliffs that you can't even see the bottom of. There are many, many times when the earth would almost move out from under them. It was pretty nail-biting as far as a bit of a roller coaster ride.
Three knee surgeries, I believe, that he's had just to keep up with his career, yes, and his passion.
It's kind of like one of those things where in your mind you know that he's going to make it to the end of the film, because, of course, you're probably aware by the time you've seen it that he's now been speaking about it afterwards. But in the moment, in your heart, you're sort of worried about that someone's not going to like fall into a glacier the entire time. It was quite exciting for a documentary.
Yeah, my favorite parts is when he's saying to the to his assistants that come out with him, and he's like, yeah, let's go onto that ledge. It looks pretty secure. Like, it's going to be okay.
And one of the major things was they were able to catch the largest ever recorded calving, which I believe is how it's pronounced properly. The calving, the chipping off of the edge of a glacier. If my memory serves me correctly, I don't know if you have the number in front of you, if you remember, it was something like 2 kilometers wide.
I remember that it took actually 75 minutes that they were filming it, so which is huge. And calving, yeah, you're absolutely right, is actually spelled C-A-L-V-I-N-G. And it's so rare to get one of these episodes actually on camera, because they happen. I mean, they were talking about going out for 3 weeks and doing what they're called glacier watching. And it just happened to happen when they were on the phone calling James and saying, oh, my God, it's happening now. And it's 1 kilometer wide chunks. Yeah, that's a funny word, coming off of a glacier and a glacier that flows 130 feet every day. And yes, it's 5 miles wide.
Wow.
That's right.
So one of the fun things about that clip, when I was searching for preview to choose to put on the website afterwards, which there will be a couple, I'll put the trailer back up and I'll put this other clip back up as well. They've actually, someone has cut up, I don't know with it's James Balog's permission or not, but somebody on YouTube has cut out just that section where they're watching the glacier fall out. So you can go and see just that one piece that they're talking about. Absolutely mind-blowing. And I think one of the important things that when he's doing his talks in the documentary, they show pieces of his journey and then also pieces of his talks that he started doing afterwards, was just the idea of like, because of the situation where you're in, like, it's mountainous, it's almost all ice, and what's not is rock, there's virtually nothing for comparison. So it can be very, very difficult to even understand what you're looking at. And so I loved how he would sort of like show something and then put in scale, and then show something and then put in scale, because your mind's sort of like, okay, so that's like a hill, or, you know, at most or something. You're like, no, that's like 14 football fields just collapsed in front of me.
Yeah.
It's astounding, doesn't even begin to describe it.
And as a speaker who shows PowerPoint presentations myself, it's great to show that scale, because people just don't get it until you show something that they understand. So one of the things he was showing was the vertical change and the Empire State Building. And he said it's double like the size of the Empire State Building that for one of the glaciers that retreated. Since 1984, this one glacier retreated 11 miles.
Yeah. One of the things that we wanted to mention this week as well was that I actually just got an email just before we were getting into the show today from Waterkeeper Alliance. So I thought, seeing as we're doing a water-themed show for today, that would just let everybody know that they're doing an actual photo contest. We'll put a link to that up on the post as well at the end. And then there was another water-themed conference that's going to be going on this weekend, film festival that's going to be going on this weekend as well. Did you have the note for that, Liz?
Yeah, it's called the Water Docs Film Festival, and it's done by Eco Logos, which is a great organization. I know a number of volunteers from there, and it's happening right now in Toronto. It's at the AGO Jackman Hall. You can get your tickets online, so you go to ecologos.ca, and it's going on until the end of Saturday. So it's I'm going to be going to see one of the films tonight. It's called Lost Rivers. It's a Canadian film, and I actually have a friend who works at the production company, so that's one reason I'm going to go. And it's going to be talking about Toronto and places in Montreal, quite for sure, and I'm not sure what other places they'll talk about also.
Definitely. So I think coming back to that, you were mentioning doing presentations. So I think I'd like to ask you about that as well. With something like this, something that I've always been interested in is the idea of sort of using a film like this to inspire people into action. It seems to be you're dealing with somewhat of a specific target area, because like you were saying, like James Balog didn't really understand. He was a skeptic, and I think he was a skeptic not in the euphemism sense of skeptic, but an actual skeptic. I think he just remained skeptical
about the science,
as opposed to someone that was like, oh, I've heard 10 theories as to why this is a hoax, as someone that I would use the label denier for. So he was just, I think, just very much someone who was scientifically literate enough to sort of understand how difficult it would be to do what the scientists were claiming to do. So he was just scientifically literate enough to realize how much of an impact we'd actually have to change climate, and that caused his skepticism, which I think is something that it doesn't be given enough credit, which is that if you aren't aware of what the science is, if you haven't really looked into exactly what modern science is saying, I think it would be highly rational to be a skeptic. It is pretty astounding to think that we humans could cause some of this stuff, and I think if a good short version for that maybe is why using something like Chasing Ice is such a good preempt to getting someone to, for instance, sign up with Climate Citizen Lobby or another group or inspiring change, because it can be to go the hard route to actually go and do all the research. There's so much information that you need, and it's not, watching this documentary certainly isn't a replacement for that sort of an education, but it can be a short form for people who just instinctively are just like, I don't understand how we could be doing that. We must be wrong.
And something that is said right at the end of Chasing Ice, he says, the problem is with perception. People don't get it. And then that's why he's using this visuals. And in all my work, whether it's volunteer work or my career, I'm finding that, yeah, it's coming down to psychology. And I'm trying to learn more and more about that psychology, Darren, because I see that is people aren't responding to the facts. You know, even being shown these images, I wonder how many people will act on them. And my favorite image from the film is the Solheim Glacier. And he show the history proves that in 100 years, it's retreated 8 miles. And then his work shows that since in a 10-year period or less, I think it's actually 9 years, it's retreated the same amount, more than 8 miles. So that, I think, is one of those statistics and visuals that says it all. But still, we're human, and human psychology is very difficult to relate to things that are not affecting us immediately. And it's also difficult to relate to situations that don't seem like emergencies. You know, if you have a tornado hit you, which actually I've had that experience when I was younger. I lived in Barrie and experienced that. But but something that's happening gradually, it's very hard to see that as an emergency. But unfortunately, if we don't act now, it's just going to get more expensive and just tougher to make a difference. Yeah. So visuals are very important, though.
And so, what sorts of reactions have you had when you're showing the film and then you're speaking to people afterwards? Generally, do people seem amazed at the photography? Because that was sort of one of the things that I wanted to identify as well, was that it's not just sort of the film is not a constant barrage of, oh my God, look what we're doing, we have to do something about this. He frequently stops and goes, you know what, if I wasn't here for such a crazy reason, like, this is stunningly beautiful. And so you're almost lulled into, it's sort of way in which some people would think, and hopefully nobody jumps at me for this, but like, you could say that something like a picture of like a mushroom cloud, if you remove what it's of, is fascinating, it's amazing, and it's sort of in the way that like fire is pretty, but of course it's all the reality of it that's horrible, and there's nothing good about nuclear weapons at all. But it's sort of like one of those things where it's just, you know, the awesomeness of the natural world around us can sort of sometimes lull us a little bit. So I'm interested in my takeout from the movie was, I knew a lot of the facts, but seeing it was shocking. Seeing the comparisons to actually put it into scale was what really caught my attention. And then his inability to avoid stopping once in a while and just smelling the roses, as it were, also really caught my attention. What have you found jumped out at people when you're talking to them after they saw the film?
Yeah, the speed, when they're presented with that visual evidence of the speed of things that are that's happening. And I think it's always great to have something that is so popular visually. I think his National Geographic cover, when he first started sending the photography in, I think it was one of the most well-sold National Geographic covers. So, I mean, these things, the more popular something is, the more it becomes mainstream, right? And the beauty of this documentary is also it's very child-appropriate, so you can bring your kids. The visuals say it all, but whether people will act on taking those steps to make some change about it, that's always questionable.
Okay, and then we're gonna take a quick break in just a few minutes here. But before we let you go just yet, Liz, I wanted to change tone on you just for a minute. Today, as you said, is March 22nd, is the day we're broadcasting this. If you happen to be listening on one of our syndicates, that would have been whatever last Friday was for you, which would have been UN World Water Day. That started in 1993. 2013 is the World Water Year, also identified by the UN, talking about water scarcity and access to clean water. So while we're sort of doing a bit of a water theme here, how else do you think that these sorts of things can, is there any sort of lag with it? I mean, we were talking a bit before the show about how there's Earth Hour, Earth Day, World Water Day. Sweden has its own World Water Week, which I thought was kind of funny.
UN
has. And even you and I have some trouble keeping track of some of this stuff sometimes. Can we get too oversaturated with this sort of thing? Is declaring something a day useful?
I think it is. I think that as many opportunities as we have to keep the climate and everything involved with it in the news, on the forefront of people's minds, I think that's great. Yeah.
Do you think that is there any conflict? And by conflict, I just mean as far as like allotment of resources and actually getting stuff done, not problems between the two. But I mean, do you think that the difference has been drawn too starkly between treating water as a climate change issue, things like its indication of like falling ice and rising sea levels and that sort of thing, so water in sort of a climate change context and the sort of human health context? Obviously these two things are linked, but do you think it's perhaps a negative that they're separated so much? Is it not better that if we were sort of talking about all these water issues as a one, rather than these UN days seem to be more focused on the public health issue of access to clean drinking water for people's safety? But shouldn't we be talking about this all together? Aren't they all related?
They are all related, but I think we come back to psychology again, and the human mind likes things in chunks and not, we're not as good integrating everything. And I think just the way that media works is also they like things in chunks. So I think people also from a psychological point of view respond better when health is an issue, because that they see hitting them more personally. So I agree with you that I wish that there was more integration, but then just from the way humans tend to think and the way media works, it seems to work better that way to segment these days. Yeah.
Okay, so that's all about what time we've got for now. We're going to keep you on for a minute. I'm going to get Kevin on the phone to talk about some news items. But for now, if you want to just remind people how to get in contact with you and the website for Citizen Climate Lobby and any information you have about Chasing Ice.
Yeah, great. Okay, so Citizens Climate Lobby Toronto chapter is actually, we're doing our first fundraiser. It's going to be on Earth Day, which is Monday, April the 22nd, and it's going to be in North York. We don't have all the details ready yet, but they will be on our website in about a week. Where the website is citizens with an S, climatelobby.ca. So I look forward to seeing people there. And if you are in Toronto, again, Bloor Hot Docs is having a documentary on Monday, March the 25th at 8:45 of Chasing Ice.
Okay. Thank you so much, Liz Rice. We'll get you back on again soon if you don't happen to stick around with us for us for now. But without further ado, we'll go to a music break and we'll be right back. And we are back. This is the Green Majority, and apparently Liz Rice, I wasn't going to mention her, but you just heard her there. So Liz Rice is still in the studio. We are now going to go to Kevin Farmer, though, who is on the phone. Kevin, how are you doing?
Hi, Darren.
Alrighty. So I didn't even talk to you about this before the show, what you were going to talk about this week. You're totally surprising me. What do you got for us?
Well, I just wanted to keep in the theme of Water Day and drop a few interesting facts about fresh water for people who are interested. And it's, you know, in Canada at least, and as far as I can tell in North America, the debate, the discourse, you know, really hasn't risen above the level of say the issue of bottled water. And maybe, you know, it's on some people's radar that there's a freshwater crisis looming in the world, but it really hasn't penetrated as of yet. And the reality is that freshwater shortages is something that we have a date with, like a sort of a date with destiny around the middle of this century, which is when you look at it and realize, well, and I'll tell you what that date with destiny is first. Right now, according to National Geographic, approximately 50% of all fresh water is diverted exclusively to human usage. So that's, you know, that's right now 50%, half of the fresh water supply is being consumed by humans. And the rate of water consumption is growing at twice the rate of population growth. So by the middle of this century, when our population increases by half again, that means if you extrapolate just making no other adjustments, by the middle of this century, our population will require 100% of the fresh water supply. Like all of it.
which is actually a perfect place. I was just, you made me think of a joke, and I always try and stick one in there that it actually perfectly sums up exactly what you're talking about, which was that everyone knows that thing about that glass is half full and half empty, right? So
right.
The thing says, when the pessimist and the optimist were arguing about the glass of water, the opportunist stole it. Which I think is kind of an amusing thing about, you know, that sort of thing, but it also exactly describes what you're talking about. You know, people talk, well, you know, 50%, you could say, well, look, you know, we're taking 50% of all the water, and be like, yeah, well, that's only half, like there's tons of left. And there's other people saying, oh, you know, we're only taking half the water, like, you know, that sort of, and sort of that thing. And in the meantime, people are scooping up all the rest of it.
Well, the thing is that obviously the world can't function with 100% of freshwater resources being diverted to human usage. So that means we've got a date with destiny sometime between now and the middle of this century when our population hits 10 billion and something. And that's, I mean, that's a timeline. So the freshwater crisis will be felt sooner than the effects of dangerous climate change. Despite the fact that both of them need to be acted on now to prevent catastrophe, and you know, like, what? Imagine a world that runs out of fresh water. It would be the most geopolitically destabilizing event in history, especially when you look at in Asia, where hundreds of millions of people get their fresh water supply from melting glaciers, which are disappearing. And you know, it's been predicted. It was a high-ranking official in the IMF several years ago who commented that we were going to be going to war over water sooner than we were going to go to war over oil. And you know, if you look at that date with destiny we have sometime between now and the middle of this century, it's very, very easy to see that that's true. And there's been a lot of work done tracing, you know, in sort of persistent world conflicts. There's been a lot of interesting articles and, you know, sort of research papers done to show that a lot of these persistent conflicts in the world often have water issues, you know, sort of, you know, in land that's being fought for, it's often a source of water,
No, I think the geopolitical angle is one that we don't we sort of mention often enough. There, it's certainly not on the top of my concerns. Not that I don't find it concerning, but I don't find that lens to be one that speaks to me as a way I like thinking and talking about these sorts of issues. But I think it's an incredibly valid one for many reasons. But the one that leaps to mind right off the bat was, you know, we're talking about people who have yet to be convinced. If we look at, and obviously this is not a right-left issue, but it's one of those things where there are stereotypes for a reason. It can be commonly true, even if it's not all the time true, that people on the sort of right of the political angle tend to be more interested in things like, you know, supporting troops and doing all these things and those sorts of ideas. And I think a war theme, just, or the theme of global conflict and you know, protecting this or that, speaks more to certain people than it does to others. And if you look back at almost every major conflict we've ever had, resources at some point was a part of it. You could argue that oil is a resource that right now our system is so designed to be dependent on that it might as well be considered a required resource like food, water, and shelter, except when compared to actual food and water. You know, we're actually talking about the end of, like, having no access to water, and not just enough such that people who are comfortably living in their comfortable, diluted North American lifestyle that maybe are avoiding some of the worst things that are happening to places like Bangladesh with rising sea levels and all sorts of areas that are going to be threatened by rising sea levels and access to clean drinking water that already have major issues with that. We're talking about, like, not enough even for the U.S. and Canada. So, I mean, that, if that doesn't get your attention, I don't really know what will. Because we're talking about not having enough and, you know, potentially causing World War III on it. And I see Liz got her pen up, so why don't you jump in at that point?
Yeah, I just, one of my presentations is actually called WaterWise, and I typically deliver that in schools, and the students are very amazed because I'm telling them things like, yeah, well, we've never had an experience of a water shortage because in Canada we're so lucky. I think we're the country in the world with the most fresh water. So you're right. Like, we look, you know, a few, not far, and there's some fresh water. But as what happened in Walkerton reminded us, I think it's been over 10 years now since Walkerton with their contaminated water, and so many people are still sick from what happened then. And the one thing that Kevin didn't mention is the industry's use of water is skyrocketing because, well, for one thing, and you might want to talk about Maud Barlow and mm-hmm. her work with water, it's extremely inexpensive for them to be using groundwater and just lake water and water in general. And now with the tar sands extracting the bitumen and fracking, it's using a lot of water. And they're not very good at using what they're calling gray water, which is recycling the water. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of challenges in using salt water. They can't use that because it's corrosive. And then there's the bottled water industry also taking out a lot of water. And a lot of what we don't know is actually how much is in the ground with groundwater. And 99% of the world's population actually relies on groundwater. So that's... in Toronto, we happen to be in a very unique situation, given that we're right by Lake Ontario. That's where we get our water from. We're the 1% in Toronto that actually gets our fresh water from a lake instead of underground water.
Okay, so I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but thank Kevin. We're going to call you back a little bit later towards the end of the program to talk a little bit more. Liz, I think you said you had to run, so this we'll say goodbye to you again, but thank you very much for coming in, and thank you, Kevin. We're going to go to a really short commercial break. Look at me go. I watch too much television. We're going to go to a really short music break. Much more important, much more fun. Also programmed by DJ Amber Waves over at Open to Midnight, who is back on track. In case you wondered why this week's music was so much better than a couple of weeks ago, that's because it was left to Ari and I to pick the music. We're back with DJ Amber Waves. Look for links and descriptions of all the songs that she posts to us. And she's also doing some Canadian Music Week giveaways. So check out her link on the website afterwards, or just go to Open to Midnight blog. But we're going to just listen very quickly to a part of a song here while we get our next guest on the phone. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Thank you.
bury your head deep in the sand. You walk on through, 'cause sticks and stones won't break your bones, but they'll change your mood. Oh, 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 oh. Now you've arrived and think it's alright to drink more than you feel. Sleep in the beds and leave them for dead. When you aim, you shoot to kill. Cause you take it all in just to let it all go.
All right, and we are back. You are listening to The Green Majority. I'm your host, Darren Kaster, broadcast on at least 18 campus and community stations coast to coast from St. John's, Newfoundland to Vancouver, BC. We're going to be going now to Jari Osborne. Jari, are you on the phone?
I am, Darren.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. We're going to be talking to you today. You are a writer, producer, and director, but we're going to be talking mostly about the documentary called The Beaver Whisperer, which is going to be playing on The Nature of Things. David Suzuki is both associated with that channel and, is, of course, with that program, and is also featured in your documentary as well. I'm thrilled that it actually worked out. It was completely unintentional that we ended up having you on this week's show, because it just sort of turned out to be a water-themed show, and I had actually even forgotten that it was World Water Day until Liz reminded me. And then we get to deal with not only something having very important about water, which fits exactly with our theme this week, but also our Canadian mascot slash icon, the beaver. So do you want to just give us a little quick introduction to exactly what it is that you were looking at here? And then I've actually got a couple clips that I'm going to play from the documentary as well. But if you want to just introduce the documentary before we go to the clips.
The documentary is called The Beaver Whisperers, and it is revolves around the premise that the beaver is potentially the unlikely eco-hero that could save the world's fresh water. So it's a bit of a, I mean, obviously it's a bit audacious, but as I was doing the film, I actually was really delighted and amazed at how much of that premise, the working premise, actually unfolded as I was capturing the material for the documentary. It's really quite amazing what these animals do, and much maligned creatures, I might add. Most people that I spoke to before I even embarked on the piece hate beavers. So, you know, they do nothing but chop down trees around cottages and flood roads and driveways, and basically they are disrespected, discredited, and much maligned. So as someone who has kind of a soft spot for telling stories about unlikely heroes, I had found yet another unlikely hero for our times.
Absolutely. I think that's a great introduction. Thanks, and we'll get back to all of that. We've got just a very short clip with a couple of different pieces from the documentary, and then we'll come right back to you.
Sounds great. Thanks.
Scientists now say there's much more to this unassuming rodent than we ever suspected.
Hi, bud.
They modify landscapes, they create landscapes, they bring water back to a world that needs water.
In fact, beavers might prove to be the most important animals on the planet.
It's like we are in the emergency room, and they are our chief surgeon.
We don't like to be outthought by a rodent. Either you love them and you never want a single beaver removed from the landscape, or you hate them and every one of them's vermin and you need to get rid of them.
We need the partnership with this little rodent to basically help us fix our mistakes. And to do that, we're going to have to do a little bit of sharing. We're going to have to make some human changes so that we can give them the things they need so that they can turn around and give us what we need, which is water.
All right, there. So I think one of the themes, I was able to watch a majority of the documentary. I didn't watch all of it, but I watched a good majority of it. And one of the themes, and I'm glad you kind of mentioned it there was as well, which was that when I thought of beavers, you know, you sort of think Canadian icon and you think building dams and stuff, but you really got an impression quite quickly, and I'm glad that you mentioned it in the introduction, Jari, that a lot of people really don't like them, and that kind of surprised me. So we'll get to why they're so awesome, sort of, I guess, afterwards. But let's start with who did you meet that has such hatred for them, and why?
Well, and you know what, I don't want to I don't want to blame anyone. There have been a lot of to me, there are some frivolous reasons for people disliking beavers, and I've certainly found cottagers who were I thought had. In my opinion, anyway, my humble opinion, my beaver-like humble opinion, had not done enough to try to accommodate living with beavers by, you know, doing fairly simple things like, you know, putting wire around their trees and things like that. But sort of more dramatically, I think I visited farmers in Saskatchewan where there is, it's one of the few places in Canada where there's still a bounty on beavers. You know, you bring in your beaver tail and we will pay you $30 to, in an attempt to pest control, to do pest control. That is the way they manage the fact that beavers make it sometimes impossible for farmers who are out there trying to grow crops, make a living, grow the food that we put on our tables, make it impossible for them to actually work the land because they are avid dam builders and they will build where they need to. They don't know that they're not supposed to build there, you know, and so they will flood these entire properties, making it impossible for farmers to actually get out there and grow their crops. So it's understandable on that level. They can be very unintentionally destructive. I don't know if you ever saw the movie Hancock about where Will Smith plays this superhero.
Oh, yeah,
he's a little
yeah.
bit degenerate. And so he goes in to save a cat from a tree or something, and he takes out, you know, an entire city block of buildings or cars. I mean, in a sense, you know, when beavers go out to do the good work, of finding water, divining water, directing it to where they need it, recharging water tables and all of that, they can, you know, make it impossible for a tractor to get onto a property. For example, they can flood out roads, they can flood them out and flood them out and flood them out. It takes an enormous amount of energy, time, and money to sometimes try to keep ahead of, you know, beavers doing damage to infrastructures. Like roads and things like that, so yeah. It's understandable from that point of view. And on the other hand, they are going to become increasingly valuable, I think, to our environment and
so
to our world.
We'll get to the idea of what an incredible benefit they show potential in just a second. But the thing I sort of that you are identifying there that I just wanted to kind of go back to for just a moment was the idea there of calling something even a pest is generally just like a some sort of living organism, be it plant or insect or mammal or whatever it is, some sort of living organism that basically doesn't obey our, you know, commands.
Oh yeah.
I mean,
absolutely.
Essentially that's the definition. So I mean, just even the idea that, you know, nobody really likes mosquitoes except for those four top mosquito researchers and stuff like, and you know, and that sort of thing. You know, most of us will agree that mosquitoes are a pest and that sort of thing. But when you're and you maybe we're just sort of splitting hairs here that shouldn't really be split, cuz I mean, life is life, but you know, beavers we think of as our mascot, and the idea that, you know, they're being a pest because they're trying to do what beavers do, and they're just doing it in a spot that's inconvenient for us. I mean, I think just that, even that whole concept speaks volumes about people in general and about sort of the way that we interact with our environment in a very generalized sense.
Oh, I think it's really interesting that you use that word too, that that people label them as an inconvenience. I mean, sort of on the scale of, you know, 1 to 10, whatever, you have people who are inconvenienced by these water-infatuated rodents. I mean, they are, after all, second largest rodent in the world. And people refer to them as an infestation when they show up on your dock or they start nibbling away at, you know, Aunt Beatrice's favorite, you know, trees and cut down the trees that you've been nurturing around your cottage. So yes, I mean, you're right. I mean, we sort of have gone in, I think, you know, and colonized their world, And we are unbelievably indignant when they, in their methodical, industrious way, kind of fight back. And they do it very, very effectively. They have, as one of my beaver whisperer scientists said, as a park ranger, she would watch teams go in and take out dams and take out beavers, and the very next day those dams could be, they would most likely be rebuilt by the beavers. And she's seen grown men cry, you know, as she would put it, after dynamiting those dams and taking those beavers out numerous times. So, you know, there has to be another answer. Is one of the questions that gets raised by a part of my film is, can we live with them? How can we live with them, and how can we benefit from living with them? They are like friends with benefits, if you ask me. You know, they increase biodiversity. They are like they help with soil erosion. If too much water is your problem, their dam building engineering skills could be part of your answer. If you're in a bone dry desert and have no water, beavers could be your answer. They are a Swiss Army knife of ecological tools, and yet we have a bounty on them.
So with that in mind, obviously there's a lot of hints in the trailer for the documentary, and they get into it very fully, and some of your beaver whisperer heroes, as you said, definitely would be able to speak to this specifically. But you mentioned things about some of the benefits, and one of the benefits that caught my attention was about dealing with climate change. But if you want to just kind of go through some of the things that had been discovered and that some of these beaver whisperers had told you about, not just mitigating the idea by finding a way to maybe relocate the beavers in a way that doesn't hurt them, but actually using them as the ingenious, evolutionarily perfected engineers that they are for benefit, outside of just simply removing the nuisance. How can we work together with them?
Well, one of the projects that I did follow in Washington in the Cascades, I follow a group of scientists who are actually working to use beavers to rebuild an entire degraded watershed that used to support salmon, but had become so, the water had become so warm, the temperature of the water had risen because the streams had become so shallow without the presence of beavers. Beavers had been pretty much extirpated in that area for many, many, many years. So they are trying to use, they're convinced that reintroducing beavers into that landscape is going to provide the cooler water that the salmon need in order to survive in those waters and to reproduce. And they have been very successful at restoring beavers to the landscape and scientifically putting the data, attaching the data to sort of anecdotes about, you know, where there are beaver, you'll find water, et cetera. They're actually measuring water levels. They've got, you know, thousands of temperature measuring devices throughout the entire watershed, and they are providing and gathering the data that is going to support the idea that the beavers are an incredibly important environmental tool for restoration in all kinds of ways.
And they
work for free. I mean, you know, and they work for free with restoration, wetland restoration running to, you know, billions of dollars. It just doesn't really make sense to not give this a really thoughtful consideration.
Mm-hmm. One of the statistics I was just going to say that I remember, or the visuals that was given that I remember in the documentary, was somebody saying, if you gave a family of beavers or a colony of beavers a water body the size of Ontario, you'd end up with a wetlands the size of Canada, just as a way of visualizing
their
ability to work with that.
That is actually the way I kind of tried to crystallize, I suppose, the scientific research. I'm sure I'm oversimplified, and I apologize to Dr. Glynis Hood, but her PhD research was looking at the effect that the presence of beavers have on the amount of open water present on a landscape, and she was lucky enough or fortunate enough and smart enough to have access to 54 years of maps, detailed maps, in Elk Island, of Elk Island Park. So she was able to look at all kinds of factors and enter them into her study, and she was completely surprised to find that more than anything, more than whether it was a year of drought or whether a year of record precipitation, that where there were beavers present, when there were beavers present in these areas, there was 9 to 10 times more water. Sometimes she said, in the year she was studying, it would have been the only water that was still available in times of severe drought where local ranchers could water their cattle. It's very extraordinary.
One of the other, one of your other beaver whisperer heroes, as you had it on there, was Michael LeClaire. And one of the things that I thought really interesting about him was his, he talks about a lot about the intricate networks of labyrinths that that beavers actually make underneath the dirt. And a lot of the time we'll just see, you sort of see the mound of sticks, and it sort of looks like they've just sort of built a dam, in the sense that they're just sort of putting a wall there. But it's anything but, and Michael LeClaire was designing something. I didn't really understand how exactly he was going to go about doing it, but illustrate the network of mazes and tunnels that they create underneath that in the dirt and the mud, so that they can sort of survive winter and protect food and have a place to raise their families and stuff. Can you say anything about his project and about Michael in general?
Well, Michelle LeClaire.
Michelle, my mistake.
Michelle is just an incredible man, a former trapper who was hired by the Gatineau Area Park to come in. He's been working with beavers now. He's actually manager of the beaver population in the park now, and has been for some 30 years. But he came in as part of a team of trappers and to manage the problem, beavers in the park who were taking out trees and flooding roads and infrastructure, making the park pretty much unmanageable. So he realized, though, that he could not stay ahead of it. They would trap and trap, and which meant at the time, of course, you know, killing the beaver and taking their dams out. And he would come back to the same location a few days later, and the dam would be totally rebuilt. And he felt like he was in some, you know, cartoon or the seventh ring of hell or something that never ended. So he decided that there had to be another way. And he discovered what triggered these animals to build so conscientiously and so unstoppably was the sound of running water. And because they need water, water is survival to them. Water is everything to them. They use it to get to their food. They use it as protection, like protection as moats around their lodges, etc. And he decided that he would be, by mimicking their engineering, he would be able to design devices that they could help him build by building, sweetening an area where he would want them to build, and using their dam building expertise to build a retention dam, which would actually keep water away from roads that were being flooded, etc. So that's one of the things that he's done. The other thing that he's, and so he, in a sense, he recruits them as flood control engineers to manage this beautiful jewel of a park. And it's very impressive. He's just such a character. He's so wonderful. The other thing that he describes to me is that, you know, if you only see the surface of something, you don't know what the beavers are doing underneath the water. He's, of course, over the years, seen many different kinds of habitats. So a drained habitat where the dam is broken and it goes through the organic process again of becoming meadowland, basically. So that if you see a drained pond, there are... It is very convoluted. It's like Drumheller or something. It's nothing for a beaver who wants to find water to dig like 20 feet down throughout a pond bottom to find water and to direct it back to where it needs it, which is wow. Right around its lodge. So you know, he is a great admirer of the beaver's dam building engineering ingenuity and skill, but he has found a way to harness that as well, that incredible drive to preserve water is something he's managed to direct. He kind of speaks the beaver language. He calls himself the plumber of the beaver dams, because he actually uses their dams to control water levels in the park.
Well, that's absolutely amazing. Unfortunately, we are out of time, but I want to thank you very much for joining us, Jerry Osborne, today. If you want to just let people know before they go, if there's a way to contact you, if people are interested, and when they can check out your very, very well-done documentary, The Beaver Whisperers.
Oh, thank you. The documentary is going to air next Thursday, March 28th at 8 p.m. on CBC television. And we have also at cbc.ca, we have a Beaver Whisperers website where you can actually watch what the beavers are doing. We have a live streaming beaver cam installed inside one of our Gatineau lodges. So, and you can tweet me there.
Awesome. So, and we'll have links to all that up on the website as well after the show in case you missed that. Again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for your time.
Absolutely. Take care.
Thanks.
And so we've got just a minute or two left here, but there was one burning question I had left for Kevin. So, Kevin, we've got about 3 minutes. I've got one last question for you today, which was I asked Liz a little bit earlier if there was any sort of sense of fatigue around having a World Water Day, World Water Week in Switzerland, World Water Year, Earth Day, Earth Hour. Does it do anything? Is it just saturation? What is your opinion on world days and weeks and years, especially now that there seems to be so many of them?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not entirely sure. What's encouraging is that there's more of them. Like the notion, I think what they represent is kind of the beginnings of consciousness on the topic, really. I think a lot of people, when they come to grips with the notion of environmental crisis, which really there's no other way to describe the situation we're in right now except a state of environmental crisis, I think people just don't know what to do or where to begin, because the problem is always so much larger than any one person. You know, you commonly see environmentalists espousing Gandhi's line, be the change you want to see in the world. And you know, they live their lives in great environmental harmony, but, you know, the landfills still fill up and the carbon emissions still increase, and you just can't, one person just can't live a green enough lifestyle to offset the footprint of society, and you get this sense of helplessness. And I think, you know, so people, when they start to come to terms with environmental issues, they don't know where to begin, they can't wrap their head around the whole thing, and we get these kind of, but what we get is these, like, days of recognition to almost to say, okay, look, we're acknowledging that there's a problem here, and I'd like to point out to people that, you know, these days are great, these observances are great, you know, Earth Hour is great, but Stephen Harper doesn't turn his lights off on Earth Hour. And, you know, I'd like to just remind people, especially now that the budget's come out with nothing in it for the environment, that, you know, a letter to the PMO's office and a letter to, you know, say, Peter Kent goes a long way, and their email addresses are very easy to find.
Well, you know what? Maybe I'll take a minute and try and post a couple of those with the website and everything else. As you can hear in the background, though, we are out of time. Thank you once again so much for joining us, Kevin Farmer.
Thanks,
I will hopefully see you next week, and I will definitely, you all will hear from me next week, because whether you listen or not, whether you tune in or not, I hope you do. I'm always here every single week, except for last week because I got a vacation, but that doesn't count. That is all we have time for today with the Green Majority. Thanks again. It is All Environmental News Hour. I'm your host, Aaron Kaster, and you'll hear from me next week. Stay tuned.